December 2020. You made it. Good job. We're days away from Christmas and less than a month away from finally putting 2020 to bed. And in these last days of this year, we find ourselves in the season of Advent, a season of waiting, a season of great expectation, a season of hope. It's the season where we turn our attention again to the coming Christ and the good news of healing and redemption that he brings for everyone. So with that in mind, we begin a new teaching series, How to Sleep at Night, the truth about generosity and how having too much is not enough. So over the next three Sundays leading up to Christmas Eve, we'll be unwrapping the gift of God's peace, a peace that makes things right, a peace that rescues the rich and pardons the poor, a peace that reverses injustice and disarms anxiety, a peace that when you close your eyes to sleep at the end of a day, drops you into a deep, unbothered sleep. In a fairly recent study, people were asked what keeps them up or what questions wake them up at night. And here were the top five responses. What do I want? Am I doing the right thing? What do people think of me? Where am I going in life? Why do I act the way I do? And so the researchers took their findings and made connections between these big life questions and how people felt. In general, the more unhappy people were, or the more depressed or more anxious they were, the more often they questioned themselves and their actions. And the study drew the conclusion that if what we value or what we think is right is out of sync with how we actually live, then we are more than likely to lie awake in bed. If we're at odds with ourselves, the late night questions bubble up in our consciousness. And we could go even so far as to say this, that the thoughts that keep us from sleep are signals that something needs to change. And not just change just for you, but for everyone. So through Moses, God addresses the late night questions that keep us up by commanding a systemic change for everyone. From the book of Deuteronomy. At the end of the seventh year, cancel all debts. This is the procedure. Everyone who has lent money to a neighbor writes it off. You must not press your neighbor or his brother for payment. All debts are canceled. God says so. There must be no poor people among you because God is going to bless you lavishly in this land that God, your God, is giving you as an inheritance. Your very own land. But only if you listen obediently to the voice of God, your God, diligently observing every commandment that I command you today. When you happen on someone who's in trouble or needs help among your people with whom you live in this land that God, your God, is giving you, don't look the other way, pretending that you don't see him. Don't keep a tight grip on your purse. No, look at him. Open your purse. Lend whatever as much as he needs. Don't count the cost. Don't listen to that selfish voice saying, it's almost the seventh year, the year of all debts are canceled, and turn aside and leave your needy neighbor in the lurch, refusing to help him. He'll call God's attention to you and your blatant sin. Give freely and spontaneously. Don't have a stingy heart. The way you handle matters like this triggers God, your God's blessing, in everything you do, all your work and ventures. There are always going to be poor and needy people among you, so I command you, always be generous. Open purse and hands, give to your neighbors in trouble, your poor and hurting neighbors. So what is going on here? Maybe a little bit of context is in order. So Israel is on the brink of a windfall. They're at the edge of the promised land, literally and finally. Everything is about to change for them, and the charge that God gives them upon entry is this. You need to operate in a different way. If things are going to be made right, then there is a certain way you need to organize yourselves. And it cannot be with the status quo. So in context, again, the ruling class had set things up in such a way that kept themselves economically viable. Meanwhile, the working class, like farmers, were always living under the threat of falling into debt, where predatory creditors could just swoop in and take advantage of a bad harvest. So today, we could compare that to credit card companies or banks or payday lenders that are only too eager to maneuver the poor into spiraling debt through high interest rates and penalties and subprime mortgages. So Deuteronomy 15 outlines a better system, and it's this. Don't covet or lust after what someone else has. Don't steal. Don't set people up and then take advantage of them. Lend at no interest. And cancel debts. That is, share resources in solidarity. And if you do all of that, God says, then no one will be poor and everyone will have what they need. And why will everyone have what they need? Well, that's because people will be looking out for one another and not just themselves. You see, in God's system, no one should be left in a vulnerable state, and everyone is entitled to protection and a life worth living. So then how does that all tie in to what keeps us up at night? Well, I think like this. A study of money and possessions in the scriptures makes clear that the neighborly common good is the only viable, sustainable context for individual well-being. Commitment to neighborly good exposes the lie of privatization and the flight from material reality. The recovery of the economic dimension of the gospel, of course, will require a rearticulation of much that passes in our society for serious Christian faith. Now, what on earth is that guy saying? He's saying this. He's saying that I can't be good if you're not good. I can't sleep at night if you can't sleep at night. He's saying that the good news of Jesus is economic. It is highly political. It impacts everything that you love, everything that you own, everyone that you know. So then, how can we live under this system of this world and at the same time live out the ways of Jesus? And how can we actually live into the changes that we know need to happen? And how is any of this really possible? I mean, I like God's big ideas, but how do we go about reversing what's already set in stone? Speaking of the coming Messiah, the prophet Isaiah paints a picture of what will be and how all of this gets done. He writes, "He will judge between the nations and will settle disputes for many peoples. They will beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nations will not take up sword against nation, nor will they train for war anymore." Isaiah is talking about the transformation that Jesus brings, transforming fighting into cultivating, transforming war machines into gardening tools. Advent is the season, then, that repurposes everything that we have. Advent is the season where God's love reverses vicious cycles. Advent is the season where we remind ourselves to practice God's new system. And hey, I know what you're thinking right now, because I'm thinking it too. Yeah, right. There's no way. We are so entrenched, so set in our ways, so proud, so bullheaded, so settled, that there is no way that we can reverse course at this point. There is no way that the world can reverse course after years and years of doing the same thing over and over and over and over again. I mean, I'm sure that's how you and I would have answered pre-COVID. But right about right now. Can the world change just about overnight? Yeah, I think we've seen it happen. I think we're living through it right now. Let me share with you just a few things that have totally reversed course in 2020. Things like, you are now allowed to cover your face and wear a mask in banks. Seriously? Or the mafia in New York is reported to be hurting for money. Why? Because people aren't gambling on sports. And why aren't people gambling on sports? Because there are no sports. Even casinos are getting desperate. Some are now taking bets on the weather. Here's another change that no one saw coming. Market analysts predict that belt sales will decline this year because people have been buying fewer formal pants and are switching to sweatpants instead. So now you know why we only shoot from the waist up in these videos. It's pretty amazing how fast marijuana went from being totally outlawed to, quote, essential. Or did you know that there is currently an overabundance of chicken wings in North America? Yeah, I guess no one's going out for wing night anymore. Weird. One last one. Since Hong Kong's Ocean Park Zoo closed its doors to the public, two pandas were finally able to mate after 10 years of unsuccessful attempts. So maybe they just need a little bit of privacy. You know what I'm saying? So all of that to say, the change, big change, is in fact possible. So as we enter into the season of Advent together, perhaps we can approach the coming days asking ourselves, what needs to change? Which cycles need to be reversed? And how do we generously repurpose what we have to help others sleep at night? Because as followers of Jesus, that's actually how we fall asleep. We look after one another.
Reversing economic cycles is a tall order. We might not have the power to change our whole means of production, but I think we can reverse the cycles that have power over us with the practice of generosity. Now, most of us equate generosity with money and resources. So if you have a lot of money, if you have a lot of resources, you have the ability to be a generous person. But in fact, generosity isn't about how much money we have. It's actually a practice that we use to help curb our inclination to keep and settle scores, to put people into boxes, and to claim the good things in our lives as things we've earned rather than been given. Generosity is a posture of our hearts, not about the bottom line in our bank account. It's like a superpower that helps us break the cycles in our lives and world that wear us down and keep us under the heel of old and tired ways of doing life. Generosity is the opening up of ourselves, of our lives, of all that we have. It is releasing the hold that our clenched fists have on certain opinions, certain outcomes, certain resources, and letting them go, offering them up for the sake of the kingdom. We're talking about generosity through the whole month of December, but today we're going to focus on being generous in our thinking, in the assumptions we make about others. But in order to let generosity flow, the first order of business is to be grateful, which was also part of our practice a couple of weeks ago. But I think that just shows how central gratitude is to our lives as humans, and especially our lives as Jesus followers. You see, generosity flows as we practice gratitude. Gratitude helps us to remember that all we have is a gift. The whole basis of our faith is that what we have comes by grace, not just our salvation, but everything we have. Our finances, our families, our friends, even the ability to get up in the morning. If you don't believe that, generosity is going to be hard because you're going to harbor the notion that somehow what you have earned, you deserve it, and it's yours to decide what to do with. But as followers of Jesus, we believe that all that we have comes from God, and that God allows the sun to shine on all people, the evil and the good, because God is so good and gracious. God's kingdom is not a zero-sum game. God breaks all the rules in order to be good to all people, and we are asked to be conduits of this same generosity. We are distributors. We are dealers of this generosity. So your first generous practice is to sit in the generosity of God for a little while. Practice gratitude. Give thanks in all things. I was reminded this summer that Paul does not say give thanks for all things, but in all things. Some of us are in rough circumstances this season, and so I get that you are not thankful for everything happening in your life, but you can be thankful in your circumstances. So practice gratitude every day. Take time to intentionally name and thank God for the really good things in your life. Gratitude opens our hands to receive the provision we need from God. It unlocks those clenched fists, and then it fills our hands with everything that we need plus more so that we can share. Gratitude sends us out into the world on mission to break and reverse cycles. The theologian Karl Barth says this about grace and gratitude. Grace evokes gratitude like the voice of an echo. Gratitude follows grace like thunder follows lightning. And I would argue that we could also say that gratitude evokes generosity like the voice of an echo. Generosity follows gratitude like thunder follows lightning. We practice gratitude, and then we practice generosity. Let me share this N.T. Wright quote to get your imaginations fired up for this practice. Kingdom that Jesus preached and lived was all about a glorious, uproarious, absurd generosity. Think of the best thing that you can do for the worst person and go ahead and do it. Think of what you'd really like someone to do for you and do it for them. Think of the people to whom you are tempted to be nasty and lavish generosity on them instead. Generosity invites us to step outside of cycles that feel inevitable and instead bring something new, something life-giving and energizing. So what would it look like to break cycles that are not life-giving? Well, like I said before, I think it could start with generosity in our assumptions. How could you practice generosity in your daily life? For instance, in your households, with your partners or roommates or children, how would you do your best to assume the best? How would you practice compassion and generosity in your assumptions about the people that you live with or live close to? Could you let your go-to explanation for their annoying behaviors be, they are doing their best, instead of, they're hopeless and everything is terrible and we're never going to make it? It's so easy to make assumptions about the people we live with based on years of calcified resentments and get stuck in old cycles that year after year drain love and compassion. What if instead you made generous assumptions about the people you live with, that you focused on the positive instead of the negative? This is a small thing, but here's an example from my life. I have one son who is very forgetful, like ridiculously forgetful. In fact, one season, the fellow parents on his basketball team had bets on whether he would show up with both shoes and a complete uniform to practices and games. It was a regular occurrence that they would be driving into the parking lot for a game or practice, and one of the Lobberham parents would be driving out to get something our kid had forgotten. He often forgets his binder, his bus pass, his homework, and now, which has really thrown a wrench into things, his mask. Well, about a year ago, I decided that instead of being frustrated about this all the time and getting angry, I was going to make the most generous assumption I could. I decided to just assume that he cannot remember things. He doesn't want to forget things. He hates forgetting things. He's frustrated when he forgets things. And when I get angry and frustrated, it just increases his shame. And it gets us entrenched in a cycle of resentment that spreads into the rest of our relationship. So now I assume that he's trying his best, which he is almost all the time. I tell him that this is just the way he's made. He's going to have a hard time being organized, and that's okay. Everyone has weaknesses. He's just going to have to come up with some strategies to deal with it. It is what it is. So now he does things like he tries to have a mask in every backpack, in every coat pocket, and I have extras in the car. And when he forgets, I don't freak out. If I can help, then I help him. And if I can't, then he deals with it. And this small change in my heart, this posture of generosity, has helped to bring new life into our relationship. I think generosity can reverse and redirect cycles in the world too. When I look at the world and think about one thing that needs to change, I think about the way that we make assumptions about people we don't agree with. We are an increasingly divided society, and we make general assumptions about people based on whether we agree with their opinions on one thing. And then we build those up, those assumptions, by remaining in communities and relationships with people who share those same assumptions. We make caricatures of those we disagree with. And instead of being open-handed and generous, instead of making room for relationship, we shut down life-giving cycles by boxing people in and instead give momentum to death-dealing cycles of division. Now, we may not be able to change the wide divisions in our country or in the world, but we can do our part in our personal lives to make generous assumptions about those with whom we disagree. And this does not mean that we don't work for change, that we don't demand justice where justice is needed, that we don't name things like racism and abuse and patriarchy for what they are. But generosity makes room for relationship, and relationship actually makes room for new perspectives, for the healing of divisions. I've shared this story before, but I love it. I think it's an amazing story of hope. Megan Phelps Roper was a member of the Westboro Baptist Church. Over the years, you may have seen them in the news. They're a fundamentalist group who believes that God is judging America, as evidenced by everything they don't agree with. Megan grew up protesting at abortion clinics and military funerals, and her church and family expressed horrible sentiments on placards outside of places where people were going through the worst moments of their lives. As she grew up, she took over as spokesperson for her church. And one of the ways that she began to share their gospel was to join Twitter and troll people. But as she developed a presence on Twitter, a few people started to message her privately and ask her questions about her beliefs and build a relationship with her. And she now credits these generous responses to her vitriol with her change of heart. She left the church, and now she advocates for and teaches people about how to have conversations with those they don't agree with. And a few years after she left the church, she also married one of the men who reached out to her on Twitter, and they have a family together. Generous assumptions can make room for something new, can make room for the healing of divisions. So, practice gratitude this week, and then practice generosity in your assumptions. Pay attention to the ways that you are caught in cycles that keep your relationships from flourishing. Pay attention to the assumptions you make about others, even those who are standing in front of you at the checkout line, maybe forget their PIN number 3 times in a row, or those people you're sharing the roads with. Pay attention to the people and situations that come your way and the possibility that generosity opens to cultivate something brand new.